Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a Crowd podcast.
We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Hemingway,
Eichmann,
Stranger in a Strange Land.
A very long book. A very, very, very long book.
A dirty book, it wishes. Hello again, and welcome to episode 84 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the history podcast that recklessly adopts Billy Joel's hit song as our marching orders to the biggest headlines, heroes, and villains of the late 20th century. I'm Katie Puckrick.
I am Tom Fordyce.
Tom, how did we get to where we are today? Billy thinks it might have something to do with the book Stranger in a Strange Land.
Talk about strange, Katie.
Oh, my goodness. I'm a little stranged out by this. So 600 plus pages. I've been making assiduous and careful notes as I read through of all the sex scenes. And listeners, no need to start unzipping your trousers and getting comfortable as I'm about to read them, because by calling them sex scenes, that's somewhat overselling it. So we're dealing with the perspective of a Martian by the name of Valentine Michael Smith. He's actually a human who grew up on Mars. And he's come to Earth, and he's trying to get in with the Earthlings and understand their physical ways. So what we learn here is Valentine Michael Smith had grokked when first he had known it fully, that physical human love, very human and very physical, was not simply a necessary quickening of eggs. And he goes on from there. So quickening of eggs is doing the dirty. So if you can achieve tumescence with that kind of filth, hats off to you. And then if he talks about other body parts, like lady bumps, breasts are referred to as mammary glands.
This is an extraordinary book, Katie. Stranger in a Strange Land. It's a massive sci-fi hit in 1961. And completely inappropriately, we have someone who's not a stranger and they're not in a strange place. It's our old favourite, Cara Rodway, back once again. Cara, if you don't remember her from her many previous appearances on Fire, is the deputy head of the Eccles Centre for American Studies. Cara, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. Yes. This is a weird one. Thank you for inviting me to talk about a very large and very strange book.
So give us a brief summary of what this remarkable book is about, Cara.
The sort of the premise is the most exciting bit. The idea is that we're in a sort of near future. It's published in 61. It's some sort of post-Third World War moment, but there's a sort of federation of peaceful countries, and space exploration is real. And a spaceship went off to Mars with humans on board. And a human child was born on Mars, but all the rest of the mission perish. And he's been bought up by the Martians. About 21 years later, the humans get back to Mars and the Martians sort of send Mike back with the humans. So that sort of setup is quite alluring and it's quite exciting. And you kind of have this opportunity to experience Mike's naivety and innocence, because whilst he's human, he has been taught to think and live like a Martian. And so, you know, gravity is too heavy for him. And so he's in this sort of military hospital. And you have the sort of the first third of the book is really about kind of some of this chicanery around kind of, you know, is he going to be sort of held by the government or some sort of, you know, so sort of kind of bit of political stuff, bit of action, because he's then sort of broken out of the hospital by one of the nurses and her boyfriend, who's a journalist. Yeah, you get it gets quite action packed, some quite exciting scenes. And then Jill, the nurse, remembers that her boyfriend, Ben, the journalist now missing, had said, oh, you should take him to Jabal, who's my friend. He's a famous writer and he'll know what to do and he'll look after us. And unfortunately, you arrive in the Jabal sections and it slows down and it becomes very discursive. It's very much, you know, smug characters talking to each other for long passages.
He's so, just holding forth, isn't he, that Jabal?
So Jabal, who basically I just thought was Hugh Hefner, that's the image I got. He's like this old dude in a bathrobe kind of presiding over his harem and there's a lot of talk of swimming pools.
Oh, yes.
So he starts to chat with Mike about sort of the nature of human, and there's a lot of discussion about kind of the role of government and the role of religion and morality. And as I say, the plot kind of slows down. There's a bit of stuff. You think it's going to get quite exciting. Mike is unimaginably wealthy because of some sort of business about the fact that his parents were really rich and he's been left these stocks, and then something about them colonizing the moon, and that means that he might be the owner of Mars as like the first human. So you sort of think it's going in one direction, and then sort of the Jabal character kind of wraps that all up neatly and kind of it's just thrown away. So yeah, so then you kind of, there's kind of the sort of challenges slightly disappear, which then means that you're really left with the chat. And so then Mike sort of grows with his sort of understanding of humanness. He groks, as the terminology is, which is meant to be sort of to understand, to empathize. And eventually he and Jill sort of go off on their own, and he sort of goes out into the human world. And I thought, oh, this could get quite interesting. And then just gets a bit odd, continues to be odd, because he turns up in a carnival being a magician, but like doing actual miracles, because he has this Martian like mind control thing going on. So like he's actually levitating her, which is, yeah. And then they go off to Las Vegas, and Jill decides to become a showgirl, and this helps her lose her inhibitions, and she sees that she is sexy, and that actually sex really is like the ultimate form of knowing, and this is how we should know ourselves and each other. And then the kind of final third of the book is Mike founding what is essentially sort of a cult, yet also a language school, because, you know, the two definitely go together. So he
cover story,
so he decides that if he can teach everybody Martian, because Martian language allows you to comprehend the universe in a different way. If he can teach everyone Martian, they will all grow together as water brothers, which is this sort of terminology for this kind of unifying of yourself with others, which definitely involves the, whatever the egg quote you had,
the quickening of the eggs. Yes.
If everyone can learn Martian, they can basically save humanity sort of through, you know, by teaching everybody this at higher level of being. But at the same time, Mike's slightly torn, although it's never really well developed, between the fact that he's realised that he isn't really a Martian, he's really a human, and actually humans have sex, and that's what makes humans great. Whereas Martians don't. They don't. Their reproduction is completely divorced from this idea of grokking or kind of coming close with other Martians. So yeah, so then you kind of, they found this cult, the Church of All Worlds, and there's this parallel church called the Fosterites, which is kind of sort of satirized in the book but sort of not, and it gets a bit odd, and it's hard to understand quite what he's getting at. Anyway, then to ruin the plot horribly for those of you who've not made it through 600 pages, there's sort of this kind of rebellion against the church, which is basically preaching kind of free love, and it's sort of like seen as a sort of amoral commune because they don't know Martian, they don't understand.
So wait, there's a rebellion against the free love, or the free lovers are rebelling against Mike the Martian?
No. There's this, so the outside world takes umbrage with the Church of the New World, and they, like, their church is firebombed, and everyone escapes via teleportation.
Neat.
This really makes it sound more exciting than it is.
I know, you're really selling it.
It's because I'm remembering all the fun bits and not doing 600 pages of men chatting to each other.
Right.
You know, smoking cigars and drinking whiskey, because apparently the future looks a lot like sort of 1952.
It really does. I mean, there's so many beautiful secretaries coming in and serving drinks and snacks.
No, and I mean, at one point I was like, is any man ever going to walk into the kitchen? And then suddenly they acquire a male chef, so that's all right. But he's called Tony, and he makes spaghetti. Anyway, so the conclusion is the church is firebombed, and Mike is basically lynched, but in this very beatific moment where he's basically Christ-like, kind of glowing golden and standing in front of them, but they still hurl bricks at him. And then, you know, there's quite sort of violent descriptions of his kind of dismembering. And then he discorporates, which is their sort of term, for Martian term for kind of going to the next level. He dies. And then the idea is that all of his disciples who have learnt Martian are going to possibly save humanity. But not really sure. But mostly they've gone back to Jabal's place with the swimming pool.
Yeah, and cigars and hot tubs. I mean, yeah, it's a cliffhanger. So Mike the Martian, obviously the original influencer, the author Robert Heinlein has created quite a fascinating world that seems like a over-elaboration of a 14-year-old boy's fantasy of what adult life is like. I'm wondering if we could just touch on the nature of the kind of splash it made, because obviously Billy Joel felt compelled compelled to include it in his magnum opus. So why were people excited about it? Was it all that sexy talk about
egg quickening? I think it's the fact that, and this is one of those things where it's, you know, reading it kind of decades later, I think you have to put yourself back in the mind of a, you know, late 50s, early 60s readers that this was challenging social mores. The idea that, you know, polyamorous, you know, relationships and, you know, the sort of, it's got this very libertarian streak about kind of, you know, which at once is very attractive to sort of the right wing, which obviously America is quite conservative in the 1950s, but then it's also then picked up by the sort of nascent hippie movement. So it manages to sort of simultaneously, I think, talk to a lot of sort of social trends. And I mean, the religion in the US was actually, you know, it was on the up in terms of attendance in the 50s, but also, you know, this is starting to be the period we have the other sort of Eastern philosophies coming in. Think of, you know, like the beat writers, you know, they're very interested in kind of Oriental philosophies. And it's also an era when, you know, because it's a little bit exciting, you know, it's sort of got sexiness in it, even though it's actually not super sexy, as you've rightly illustrated. I think that people do recommend it to their friends. It's like, have you read it? It's like, it's amazing, like, so my full suspicion is a lot of people read it and were like, oh, I'll pick the bits I like, but actually that bit's really boring.
I wonder, Katie, if it's one of those books that gets a reputation, maybe in schools or colleges or around dinner tables, and people buy it as a result of that, and then they read it and never make it to the end. One of those.
Yeah,
sort of
I think that's quite possible. And I think, you know, Heinlein was well known as a writer of what they call juvenile fiction. So he basically spends the 50s writing one book every year for his publisher that's basically for a male youth market. They always came out sort of in the autumn just before Christmas. So I tried to explain the structure of the book, and I think that the production history of it kind of speaks to that. So he apparently had the idea for Stranger in Strangeland in the late 1940s. One of the sort of inspiration points was his wife saying, you know, could you do a sort of modern Jungle Book? And so rather than being raised by wolves, you know, Mowgli's raised by the Martians, like, what would that do? And that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
As I say, a lot of the kind of conceptual, the starting points are all quite interesting.
Yeah.
And so he apparently started sort of making notes for it in this moment when he's writing for young readers. And you get a lot of that sense because Mike is sort of naive. He comes back to Earth and kind of it's all about sort of learning and growing and kind of making your way in this sort of dastardly adult world. And then he puts it aside, works on all these other sort of juvenile projects. And then he has this big change in his work kind of in the late 50s when there's a lot of debate, obviously, about nuclear power and the bomb. There's a move away from doing, I think it's atmospheric nuclear testing. And Heinlein, who was a Navy man professionally, he's an engineer by profession before he kind of moves into his writing, is really horrified by this. He thinks that this is not where America should be going. We should not be, you know, reducing our military capacity. You know, the Soviets will come for us. And so he stops writing the juvenile books and writes Starship Troopers, which is the other book he's probably most famous for, which is this uber militaristic book about, well, basically, you know, communists as bugs metaphor. You know, you've got to go and fight the sort of hive mind, mindless bugs. So Starship Troopers kind of basically then launched him into this more sort of adult mode. And so then he writes Stranger in Strangeland. So lots of people sort of looking at his work sort of chart this difference. And I think you can really see it that he had, as I say, he'd started work on the book at a previous moment. You get the sort of all the sort of opening bits, which are actually a bit more interesting, kind of in that sort of world building, kind of making you sort of, you know, disassociating you, making you question things.
Yeah.
And then you sort of, then he picks it up in this sort of, you know, the world's going to hell in a handcart moment and starts sort of discursing. And that's when it all super slows down.
Let's talk a little bit about the vibe of the book, the tone. It seems a little indigestibly whimsical to me. Like a lot of the tone comes from the naivete of Mike the Martian, who is very like, oh, explain your Earth ways to me. I see you humans pressing your lips against each other. And that becomes very wearying to me. But I think author thinks that he's being kind of cutesy with it.
Yeah, for sure. But that's also simultaneously. So that sort of naivety is then simultaneously set against this kind of overwhelming smugness of all of the adult male characters.
Yeah, and there's a lot of smugness and there's a lot of men in there.
Yeah, so you have Jubal, very much the kind of Heinlein stand-in. You know, he's a sort of super successful, popular author, but he's also a doctor and a lawyer.
And he knows everything.
And he knows everything. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so this is this sort of idea, you know, which people talk about, I think occurs a lot in Heinlein's fiction, is the idea of the competent man, the idea that you have to be over everything so that no one can control you. This is how you're going to be the libertarian individual and control your own destiny, is by being across everything. And that really comes across in the Jubal character. Then you get a bit in Ben, the journalist. But it's very odd because the dialogue, really, when I first started reading it, I was like, this sounds like a kind of 1940s, like quick talking, you know, kind of like
screwball
drama. Like, yeah. It's like, you know, it's all these sort of, you know, there's like little payoffs between Ben and his girlfriend Jill, and it's all these sort of quick fire, and then everyone's constantly
banter.
Like, yeah, the banter, and then it's sort of jokes where obviously Heinlein means it to be sort of make everyone sound sophisticated and like they're getting over their sort of, you know, sexual hang-ups, but actually it just ends up sounding really, really misogynistic and like, you know. Yeah, so the women definitely are very underdeveloped in comparison with these men who get to speak a lot.
Not with their memory glands, they're not underdeveloped.
No, or the sort of lascivious kind of descriptions of the tattooed woman who turns up in the sort of in the kind of later half of the book, who likes being naked and draped in snakes, and it's just like it's like some sort of 12-year-old fantasy.
That's exactly how it came across to me, and then Katie, you referred to it as a 14-year-old fantasy. That's how it comes across, and I couldn't work out if Heinlein, the author, has done this deliberately to appeal to his audience,
right,
or whether he is still a 14-year-old boy.
Good point.
Yeah, and I'm not entirely sure either, because you're left quite confused. I think that lots of the different sections don't necessarily meld together, like I said, and also, you know, I think where he thinks he's being satirical about some things just doesn't quite work, and so you're then left with this sort of feeling that actually, well, you know, maybe he does think that some of this is actually quite utopian and kind of good, but where am I meant to sort of stand?
Because this is the problem that I have, Caro, the tone wibbly wobbliness of like, is this the satire bit or is this him preaching?
Yeah, and it becomes really unclear
kind
of where you are. And given that he's got a lot of pages to do it, I can't help feeling that actually that's a bit of a failure on the part of the author, that you don't. I mean, maybe he was just unsure. I mean, he said later that he wanted the book to just propose questions, and he got a bit frustrated that a lot of readers had taken it and gone, oh my goodness, like this, you know, if we all just like had free love and kind of got over our hang-ups, then like, and if like, frankly, all the women were constantly sexually available and like wouldn't turn me down, like the world would be great. And it's like, well, he sort of said, oh no, he backed away from that, said, oh no, no, that's not what I meant. I was just asking questions.
Yeah,
but you're
he wrote an incel fantasy and now he's trying to cover his ass, pretty much.
It's also, I mean, it's a long book anyway. It's 160,000 words. It was originally 220,000 words. So, I mean, here we are struggling with certain chapters or certain epic sections of boredom. And the editors have done us a massive favour by trimming 60,000 words off it.
I think he trimmed it, though, didn't
he? Yeah,
he did.
So it took about a year. So apparently he'd finished it in 1960, but basically had this sort of year of kind of back and forth with the editor. And he did cut a lot by all accounts. But I think in then cutting, he then actually had to put in some new stuff to then try and explain how you've got to places. But he refused to kind of take out the sort of religion and sexuality bits, which is basically where he saw the sort of the heart of the book. So all I can imagine is that he chopped out yet more men drinking whiskey and smoking cigarettes and discoursing on, you know, the failed nature of organised religion.
Katie, I found from Robert Heinlein his 5 rules for writing, and as someone who has spent a lot of his life writing, I was quite interested by these.
Yeah.
I then found myself slightly underwhelmed for reasons that may become apparent. Rule number 1 of his rules for writing, you must write. Okay, yeah, probably had got that far, Robert. Number 2, finish what you start. Yeah, makes sense.
Good.
Number 3, interestingly, bearing in mind what we've just said, refrain from rewriting except to editorial order.
Oh.
So I get a sense of sort of anger there that he's been made to chop 60,000 words off his massive book. Points 4 and 5 are really quite prosaic. Point 4 is put story to market. And point 5 is keep story on market until it is sold.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, that when I read those, it really spoke to me of the kind of, there is this very curious sort of, let's say, libertarian capitalism sort of stream that goes through the writing. And by all accounts, Milton Friedman sort of picked him up kind of in later years and sort of, you know, some of his sort of ideas formed into his thinking, his economic thinking. So one of the things that Heinlein is credited with is popularizing the phrase, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Ah, I thought that was a Milton special.
It's not. Oh. So it comes from Heinlein, who borrowed it in turn from somebody else.
Oh, okay.
But
Milton is, just to explain, he's the sort of father of monetarism.
Yeah. And Heinlein's politics is really a sort of basically the trajectory of the US in the mid 20th century, because he starts out, he has to leave the Navy because gets medical discharge. And so in the 1930s, he's in California, and he gets really involved with local sort of radical democratic politics. So he helps Upton Sinclair, the author, try and run for governor. He's really involved. I think it's called EPIC, and I can't remember what the anagram stands for. It's a poverty reduction kind of campaign. But then World War II has this massive change on him. Sort of, you know, then in the 1950s, he basically just gets increasingly conservative, you know, very much that sort of anti-communism. By 64, he's helping Goldwater's presidential campaign, you know, for the Republicans.
He is so right-wing, Goldwater.
Yeah, so that's and I think that's one thing that's quite interesting to see. And as I said, particularly the sort of libertarian tendencies, you know, which have always obviously been in American culture, this idea of, you know, the sort of the frontier and the self-made man and the fact that, you know, we're going to break away from oppressive rule of Britain and we're going to go it alone and, you know, all that sort of stuff that you can trace through so many aspects of in continuing contemporary American life and sort of political thought. So, yeah, so that's, I think, is one thing that's quite interesting about him at this tipping point, that, you know, he gets embraced by conservatives in the 1960s, but he's then also basically embraced by the hippies. You know, they see all this, you know, loving in the nest, as it's called, which is basically, it's just more Hugh Hefner, honestly.
Oh,
it's
loving
just like
in the nest. Is
it's
that,
a car, it's basically like a carpeted sex room with snakes.
Shag carpeted, I hope. Hey,
very much. That's definitely the description. Sort of soft underfoot.
And also, I like that everybody, once they're inducted into this cult, this very promiscuous cult, because, you know, you can't have a cult without promiscuous sex. It goes together like scotch eggs and brown sauce, pretty much. But yeah, I like how everybody refers to each other as water brothers, no matter if they're ladies or gents.
And that is, so I read a literary critic talking about it, which I think have the quite interesting point that one of the things that Heinlein does with the language is he does force you to take a step away by incorporating terminology that doesn't totally make sense, like water brothers or like grok, which is a created word. You as the reader, even if, you know, for a split second, you have to pause because it's like it just doesn't momentarily work. And so that does make you as a reader sort of step out and do the questioning that obviously Heinlein sort of wants you to do. But the water brother thing is it just gets odder because obviously, so it's all this sort of free love. And you're like, you know, Mike is the Martian. He's on this very intellectual sort of plane. And I sort of thought, oh, this could go in quite interesting, you know, pansexual ways. Mm-hmm. But of course it doesn't. As soon as any suggestion of, you know, wanting to kiss a male water brother,
no, there's no,
that
there's
is
no,
shut down.
There's no man-on-man action here.
None at all. And yeah. And there's some really kind of really unpleasant and unfortunate kind of lines describing the sort of the wrongness of the in-between, basically meaning the homosexual. Oh. It's just horrible. Similarly, as we've alluded to, you then, you know, when everyone's freed of their sexual inhibitions, all that means is that all the women will want to sleep with all the men.
Yeah, finally. They got their head right on that one.
You know, no idea that actually, you know, even if they were offered that choice, women might actually be picky. They might actually want, you know, to say.
They don't know what they want.
So that's, you know, those kinds of themes that the Water Brother is meant to kind of encompass this sort of, this you know, utopian almost, you know, kind of openness. And it definitely doesn't in the book.
Spread them. So let's talk about grok. Very interested in that. In fact, I recall that Margaret Macmillan, who was our H-bomb guest and our England's Got a New Queen guest, used the word grok when we were chatting. And I now realize that she may be a water brother. But this is
Thou
art God. We are all God and ready to get moist, apparently. My eggs are just quickening thinking about it. But grok, that's a very interesting creation that, much like No Such Thing as a Free Lunch, he popularized and, in fact, he created this term. And that's quite a big impact for somebody who is advocating the force and the impact of words, you know, on culture and the power of language to change minds and to elevate society. It seems to me, Cara, that the use of the word almost operated like a secret handshake at the time for those in the know.
I think you're totally right. And I think that's, you know, it's like that with, you know, with many sort of cultural products that kind of get to that point of being kind of defining of an era or of a moment. You know, the fact that you're in the know, that you can reference it, that you can. Margaret's of an age, I'm sure she wouldn't mind me pointing out that, you know, she would have been there this, you know, this time around, you know. And maybe that's, you know, that's a sort of hangover from her own, you know, experiences as a young person. Yeah, but it's in the you know, Oxford English Dictionary. It's, you know, it's become that level of importance, as you say.
There are other things, Cara, that Heinlein is supposed to not have invented but have seen coming. And I always wonder, Katie, with science fiction authors, they're basically throwing a lot of darts, aren't they? About what's going to happen. And they're going to hit the dartboard with some of these darts. So I've read that he comes up with the idea, slightly strangely, Cara, of the waterbed.
This is one of my favourites, I have to say. So as Mike the Martian is lying in the hospital, it becomes apparent that it's a sort of waterbed. And that kind of, that did make me think. I was like, oh, when is the waterbed from? Because I'd never given it much thought.
Right.
But then this, again, sort of slightly Hugh Hefner-ish trend with the book. My favourite thing with this is that, so Heinlein had been, as I said, he'd had this period of sickness in the early 30s. He'd spent a lot of time in hospital. And apparently out of this experience of basically being in bed a lot, he had come up with this idea for a waterbed that would be more comfortable for the patient, you know. So it was very much in this sort of medical context. And he mentioned the waterbed in another story and then again in this one. And then in 1968, a man called Charles Prior Hall tried to patent a waterbed, but the patent was turned down because there had been previous artistic representation pointing to Heinlein's work.
Huh.
So then what I then enjoyed, there was the little detail that obviously Mr. Hall continued to fight it because he was like, I can see a good thing here. And eventually in 1971 was granted a patent for his variation.
Yeah, it's, you know what, here I am mocking Robert Heinlein, but he came up with the waterbed and he invented grog. So those are both really...
Well, also, Katie, he apparently came up with the idea or discusses something similar to the cell phone 38 years before it's actually done.
So he was very interested in technology. So he was an engineer. But then that's always the joy of reading old science fiction, is obviously what works and what doesn't.
You know,
we all know that the Star Trek communicator is like, you know, basically became a mobile phone, and that's quite enjoyable. But, you know, there's funny things in this book where, like, the only way that they can imagine a big TV is like a big TV. And you know how like 50s TVs were like massive because you had the whole, like, the screen had the big like tunnel behind it.
They were very deep.
So all the descriptions of like these TV screens, it's not like, you know, you just pulled down a curtain and projected on it. It's like they're just huge and they're called stereovision. I think the idea is meant to be that maybe they're slightly 3D. I'm not sure. But it's just the fact that they were always described as massive, which really made me laugh.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. I've got a question for you. How is your social battery feeling right now? Because it can be easy to ignore how we're feeling and sometimes spread ourselves too thin. You know what it's like. Social gatherings are starting to pick up pace after the long drag of winter. But what's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? Well, therapy can help give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So if you're thinking of exploring these areas and starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/WDSTF for We Didn't Start the Fire. That's betterhelp.com/WDSTF. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Always fresh and never frozen, each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat flexitarian, so with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. So last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon. It was absolutely delicious. These are no fuss, no mess meals. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savour the good stuff.
With over 60 add-ons like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies, there's plenty of options to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Plus, you can customize your weekly meals and pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/WDSTF50 and use the code WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WDSTF50 at factormeals.com/WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. There are other tropes that are Martian friend. I don't know if he introduces them to science fiction or he's reflecting them, but they are classics of the genre. So when he comes down to Earth, he can't understand war. Of course he can't understand war. No alien has ever understood war. He can't understand clothing, which is handy for the free love that will follow. And he can't understand jealousy.
Aww. Yeah, well, the idea is that the Martians are, you know, a race that's developed kind of beyond the sort of the need for the corporal.
They're like our better selves.
Yeah, that's sort of the idea. But again, there's a lot of kind of uncertainty in the book. You're not totally sure whether it's all a good thing that the Martians are sort of kind of cerebral, because then actually there's a comment that actually, this is towards the end again, sorry, plot spoilers for those of you, you know, on page 550. there's a realization, Mike realizes, because he has this telepathy, he realizes that actually that he had been a spy, that the Martian elders had sent him, and they'd basically used him to learn all they could about Earth, and they've then just broken their connection with him. And he suddenly says, well, you realize that the asteroid belt used to be a planet and the Martians destroyed it like millennia ago. And I'm worried that they're going to do this to Earth. So this is partly why I want to teach everybody how to speak in Martian, how to, you know, understand this higher moment so that they can save humanity and basically convince the Martians not to get rid of us.
I want to talk about the famous adherence to the book's message. You talked earlier about the fact that it seemed to appeal equally to right-wingers and hippies. Charles Manson is mysteriously attached to the book. Mysteriously, I say, because apparently he was illiterate.
Yes. And so the version of the story, again, this is slightly contested. I think there's sort of Heinlein fans who would like to kind of move as far away from the association, understandably, with Manson as
sure.
you can. So in 63, he's in jail. And, you know, he's had this sort of life of petty crime. And he hears other prisoners talking about Stranger in a Strange Land and also L. Ron Hubbard's book, which I'm now going to
Dianetics.
Get the title. Thank you, Dianetics.
Yeah, so that's the beginning of Scientology.
Yes, yeah, so it's an early 50s kind of self-help manual that then basically becomes Scientology. And yeah, Manson doesn't actually read them. He just basically is, you know,
He absorbs them.
And this is obviously part of his sort of, you know, awful skill, is that he manages to sort of, you know, to draw in all these influences. And then by the time he's out of prison in 67, he kind of, you know, he's reformed himself as the sort of street preacher in Haight-Ashbury, gathering adherents to his kind of, you know, totally sort of bizarre pop culture melding of all these different influences, you know, from the Beatles through to Stranger in Strange Land. So he does, and, you know, again, you know, he definitely didn't wade through all the boring, you know, bits about the nature of religion. What he picks up is the rituals, so the water sharing. He kind of introduces that to his followers. They use grok and grokking as part of the sort of cult terminology. And then also he has this promise of transcendence. You know, he tells his followers, if, you know, if you follow me, you will reach the higher plane. But he definitely wants it just for his adherents. If you remember, for the outside world, he wants this horrible race war that's going to destroy...
Helter Skelter.
Yeah, destroy everything else. And he and his followers will then be in command of the kind of broken human race. So, yeah, and he did apparently called one of his children
Michael Valentine.
There's definitely a connection, and that new kind of scandal around the book. Obviously, it'd already been hand-wringing about the fact that it proposed, you know, this sort of challenge to contemporary social mores, you know, through sort of free love, and that was this suitable for, say, school libraries, and then obviously the connection to Manson when it kind of emerged. You know, it's obviously a hideous connection. I think it obviously added to it, gave it an infamy.
So I think that's, without wishing to defend Heinlein too much, because I'm not an enormous fan of this book, Katie, when he starts being blamed for Charles Manson in the way that some people try and blame the White Album for Charles Manson, you feel like pointing out that Charles Manson was an absolute lunatic who sucked in various things, and the things that made Charles Manson do the things he did weren't Beatles songs.
No,
composed it was by Paul McCartney with loads of heavy metal reverb on them, or science fiction books. They were the stuff going on in his head.
Very much so. And you know, he obviously, yeah, he pulled it all together in a way that made sense to him, and which he then realised that he could use, you know, in this very sort of awfully sort of zeitgeisty way. He basically pulled in all these features that were attractive in popular culture, in science fiction, in the formation of a cult in terms of Scientology, and then mixed them all together in this really sort of hideous, explosive moment. And then obviously, you know, as many commentators then point out, obviously, you know, Sharon Tate's murder and the Manson family as the sort of, you know, this kind of awful end of the freedom of the 60s.
It also links, Katie, in one of our tendrils that Billy spreads out, also links us, the Manson story, to our second episode, which was Doris Day.
Yes.
Because it's Doris Day's son, Terry Melcher, who's the record producer who records Charles Manson's first efforts. And then it's Terry Melcher he's trying to get revenge on, isn't it? When he
goes to Terry Melcher's house.
Old house. Which is where Polanski and Tate are renting.
Yeah, because Terry Melcher declined to give Manson a record contract. Yeah. So he blamed him for stepping on his dreams. Yeah, it's a weird, tangled, little, strange pop culture web, for sure. One of the things that interests me, Kara, is this insistence on the idea of language being able to elevate people and salvage our worst tendencies, which is very naive. It would be lovely if it were true. But in my research, I noted online there's a lot of very zealous defenders of the book, just saying, oh, anyone who's casting aspersions on it, who don't get it, who are mocking it for its perceived limitations, you just need to do a deeper reading of it. You didn't properly grok it. And it's that kind of idea. You see it kind of coming up often with young men towards figures like Jordan Peterson, you know, Canadian college professor, or Elon Musk, these sort of figures who are a little messiah-like and a little almost culty, who do tend to hold forth pedantically, and they may or may not be brilliant, but still, they do have their adherents. And it seems that Robert Heinlein attracts that same sort of thing. Like, you know, that to me, that's just so funny. It's like, oh, you don't like it? You just need to eat more of it. Like, you hate spinach? Well, eat a spanakopita and have cream spinach and have a spinach shake, and then you'll love it. Like, no, I really just don't like that flavor.
No, and I think one of the things we were talking earlier about, the sort of tone of the book and the style, and I called it smug, but part of that comes from the fact that all of these characters, particularly the men, are drawn with incredible confidence. You know, they all announce all of their observations as if they are fact. You know, you couldn't possibly question this. You know, this is just how it is. And there's a certain sort of self-assurance, which I think is quite attractive, or it can descend into smugness. And it just really depends on the point that you approach the work from.
So he's one of the big three of the science fiction writers of this period, isn't he? Heinlein. There's him, there's Isaac Asimov, and there's Arthur C. Clarke. Now, Carol, this is not really my genre, but I looked at that. Were there any women writing science fiction at this time, or was it a very male genre?
No, I mean, I don't think there were. It's a very male genre. There probably were a few, you know, I would imagine that, you know, if you Google, I'm sure you can find some women maybe writing under pseudonyms. You know, there was an explosion in science fiction writing, particularly in the 1950s. This is the golden age of sci-fi. You've got Astounding Science Fiction magazine, which incubated a lot of these writers, including Heinlein. You know, as we've been doing with this book, it's quite hard to find really sort of positive female characters who aren't, you know, completely you're hamstrung by having to, you know, be super sexy all the time, or, you know, so it's it definitely, I think it takes sort of into the 70s, and I think sort of second wave feminism, before you start to see more diversity coming into the sort of the science fiction publishing realm.
I guess you could throw Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, in there, but she's kind of the one towering example.
Yeah, you know,
in a field of nothing.
Yes, and I think, you know, but she is incredibly, obviously, influential. You know, particularly on the monster story, the kind of dangers of science. You know, all these themes that then, yeah, but she's writing 150 years before this. You know, it's a long time. And, you know, you do then get into Ursula Gwynne and sort of, you know, other figures who appear later. But I definitely, you know, you don't think of 50s science fiction as a sort of golden era for women's sci-fi writing.
And what is it about that period, particularly America, that means science fiction is such a huge genre? What's it reflecting in the wider world?
Well, some of it is just, you know, the fact that technology is advancing at kind of breakneck speed. You know, I came and had a, you know, enjoyable chat with you guys in the Dacron episode about, you know, how futuristic people wanted their homes to be. This idea that, you know, that technology was going to save us. But there's obviously also the underside, particularly the result of the atomic bomb, end of World War II, that actually it's also going to be mankind's undoing. So that tension around, you know, at once these sort of all this wonderful technology that's making our lives better, you know, be that television in the home or the microwave or a dishwasher. But at the same time, you know, there's mutually assured destruction, and the globe just witnessed the destructive power of science in, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So and also obviously then you have the space race, which is the other major context. You know, you have the Nazi rocket program, you know, the very kind of morally ambivalent moment when, you know, German rocket scientists are being being brought to the US to grab a march on the Russians. The fact that, you know, if you're a kid born in the 1950s, as my dad was, who loved all this era, you know, it was, you know, there was so much possibility, you know, you might actually go to the moon. And then we did. It's a really rich period of scientific advancement and social change as well. This idea that society could remake itself. I was mentioning about some interest in religion at the same time. So yeah, there's a lot of energy which goes into this sort of sci-fi popularity. And Heinlein is an important figure because he is one of the first authors, he's credited as being one of the first authors to break out of just kind of genre pulp publishing. So he has a story that appears in the late 40s in the Saturday Evening Post, which was a popular mainstream magazine that was read across the country. And this was in the histories of sci-fi. This is always the moment that, you know, that sci-fi broke out. You know, he is a very interesting character. I mean, it's, you know, you compared him, you know, what's called the other three, you know, the three of Clarke and Asimov, but those names have remained in the kind of the broader cultural conversation, possibly in a way that Heinlein hasn't. So I do think that his star has somewhat fallen in a way perhaps that some of the others, or then people who came later who did different things with the kind of the cultural sort of revolution in the 60s, like Kurt Vonnegut. I think his ambivalence possibly, you know, has maybe been slightly his undoing, the fact that it is quite hard to know exactly what to make of it in a way that, you know, perhaps something like Slaughterhouse Five, you know, is so sort of avowedly anti-war. And, you
yeah,
know, kind of,
well, I mean, Vonnegut is a superior writer anyway and has a surer hand with satire. So there are a lot of tangy ideas in Stranger in a Strange Land, still worth questioning this idea of, you know, are we being controlled or released by organized religion? And the idea that replacing organized religion with something that is seemingly a little more spontaneous and free is also a different way to organize a religion. So it's just one cult replacing another. And this idea that ways that humans accept as conventions and the only way to interact can be looked at from another angle, i.e. from Mike the Martian, who questions it. So all those ideas are really valuable to look at. How has the book held up today?
Well, I think as our discussion has sort of suggested, I think elements of it seem naive or at least kind of hard to like, perhaps, from a sort of, you know, multiple decades on, you know, particularly things like the sort of the powerful sexism, for example, which really kind of runs counter to this argument of sort of freedom. And obviously, we know that this is a massive criticism that the 70s, you know, second wave feminism made about the free love movement, that actually, you know, it was just a new way to control, you know, female sexuality. You could tar women with being a prude if you didn't want to, you know, immediately pop some birth control pills and, you know, give yourself to any man.
The thing that I always recall is in the Laurel Canyon music scene in the late 60s and early 70s, where, you know, everyone from Jim Morrison to the Mamas and the Papas, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, they all lived up in the canyon. And I think it was Stephen Stills who said something like, birth control pills are fantastic. Like, you don't have to worry about knocking people up. And so it was not a question of, like, from the woman's point of view of, like, oh, you know, I don't have to worry about raising a family before I'm ready. It's just from the men's point of view of, like, I don't have to be saddled with some screaming brat.
Yeah, and there's sort of, you can kind of give one point to Stranger in a Strange Land, because there is, it happens sort of off off camera, as it were, but Smith's mother is one of the scientists on the Martian mission that where they all die. But she's presented as an incredibly able engineer and scientist, and she is credited with having invented the Lyell drive, which enables this interplanetary travel. And so that's like the one kind of really exciting sort of positive sort of, you know, professional woman. But yeah, otherwise, you know, all the sort of the treatment of, you know, even in this sort of slightly utopian, you know, we're all fine. As I say, it still just looks like Hugh Hefner's, pad, because, you know, basically the women are just there to be secretaries and make the dinner, even though they've got modern technology. So it only takes about 30 seconds to get the dinner on the table.
They're very clever, these serving wenches as well.
I think it's got, we are rightly criticizing many aspects of or shining a light on aspects of this book. It's a good title.
It's a very good title.
It's a quote from the Book of Exodus, is that right?
It is, because Moses had to roam away from his home, and this is the idea that Mike has... Yeah, it speaks to the tension in Mike's character, which, as I said, I don't think is so well developed, but this idea of, you know, where is he the stranger? Is he the stranger on Mars, or is he the stranger on Earth?
I'm wondering, Cara, what you think its true value is now, because sometimes these books, that even if they don't hold up as a work or, you know, any sort of cultural offering, it still perhaps is an insight into mid-century America, or does it just operate as a little view into the inadequacies and fantasies of Robert A. Heinlein?
I think it can probably be both. You know, I think on the one hand, exactly, you can. You also need to remember, I think it's very easy to imagine that kind of that transition from the 50s to the 60s is almost like a light switch, that, you know, it's conservative 50s and then it's free love 60s. And actually, of course, there's this transition moment. And I think that this, I think, really does nicely sort of speak to that, where you do have somebody trying to kind of trouble existing conservative attitudes. And then what the public takes from it is, wow, wouldn't it be great if we were liberated, if, you know, the free love, the kind of the sort of self-reliance, that all that sort of the stuff that then gets kind of adopted by the hippies. Whereas, as I've said, at the same time, it's also quite sort of oddly conservative, particularly in this sort of libertarian, you know, you don't need anything from the government. You're better just looking after yourself. You know, that's the best way to be. So I would say that sort of thinking about 1960, 61, this is a good way to do it.
And to finish it, Cara, with that final rule that Robert Heinlein had for writing, keep story on market until it has sold. How much money did he make out of it? Did he fill his boots?
He did very well. It was significantly the first science fiction novel to make it onto the New York Times bestseller list. And that was a big deal in terms of genre publishing. By all accounts, he wasn't very happy that it was being marketed as a science fiction. He thought that it should be something bigger, the sort of, you know, the great American novel. But it served its purpose, and it continued to sell well. You know, even in the 90s, when this longer edition was produced, apparently it sold 5 million copies by that point.
What?
You know, which is quite remarkable. And it continues to be in print in multiple versions. You could get the original short version. You can get this longer sort of director's cut.
I like how you call it the original short version, and that is over 600 pages.
Yeah, this is definitely relative.
Listeners have gotten the full measure of our POV on this work, but I wonder how it was received at the time, Cara.
So it actually wasn't very well reviewed in the sort of serious press, although a lot of it found a lot of fans, as we discussed. But I did enjoy, this is Orville Prescott writing in the New York Times in August 1961. He says, Mr. Heinlein writes of earthly and American matters from the supremely unworldly point of view of a Martian, but his satire of international politics, religion, various kinds of corruption, and many ordinary customs is singularly ineffective, crude, and tedious. Mr. Heinlein has little gift for characterization, a flippant and heavy-breathing style, a ponderous sense of humor, and a sophomoric, brackets, high school, not college, enthusiasm for sex.
Bitchy.
It's difficult to tell whether Mr. Heinlein thinks that his monotonous variations upon an erotic theme are funny, or whether beneath all the verbiage and leering lubricity, great, there is supposed to be some serious plea for the innocent promiscuity of Smith's cult. In either case, much of Stranger in a Strange Land is puerile and ludicrous.
Oh, leering lubricity.
What was this critic's name again? Orville?
This is the amazingly named Orville Prescott.
Well played, Orville.
Oh, Orville, I am so in your corner. And I'm in your corner, Dr. Cara Rodway. Thank you so much for coming in and explaining the unexplainable.
I did my best, and it was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Well, Katie, that was very enjoyable. It feels like my eggs have been whisked, or whatever it is that... What was meant to happen to my eggs?
Quickened,
have they? I've poached my eggs while listening to that.
I've worked up quite an appetite. I'm feeling like I'd enjoy an omelette just about now, or perhaps a souffle. I don't know why.
Are you going to find yourself dipping further into Robert Heinlein's back catalogue in the aftermath of this show?
I think I've had my fill of Stranger in a Strange Land and his very strange voice. I'm wondering if Billy Joel, as a young whippersnapper, was doing much like what I was doing, which is to flip through to the dirty bits.
I reckon the exact page numbers containing the dirty bits were well known in whichever high school Billy attended.
Page 562.
It's, you know, it is really frustrating because I am trying to get off reading this thing and you just can't, you know, as much. There's a lot of like fanar allusions to beautiful women serving men very eagerly, wanting to induct Mike the Martian into the joys, the physical pleasures of being a human, and him just going like, oh, I don't understand. So you can imagine that young Billy would have enjoyed that idea, that specter of ladies fighting to kiss him. And maybe that came to be when he became a pop star.
I'm sure it did, Katie. We will be back next week, of course. As always, if you would like another podcast to listen to before then, have a listen to .com, The Hacking. Now, .com is our tech strand, and it's you, Katie, it's you.
Guilty as charged. It lifts the veil on the people of the internet. This latest series, as you rightly mentioned, is called The Hacking, and it's all about the twisted and ripped from the headlines world of Russian ransomware, where cyber gangs are hacking into companies, schools, supermarkets, the highest levels of government, and possibly they're lurking in your computer right now. They're stealing data and demanding insane ransoms for the return of this data. The attacks are on the rise, and I want to know who's behind them and why.
Katie, I'm quite happy to blow some smoke here. It is a totally immersive and fascinating listen. Just search for .com, that is D-O-T-C-O-M, The Hacking, and subscribe now.
And if you want more of Fire, make sure you follow us on Instagram and Twitter, and we're at Spread That Fire.
And if you have any idea for guests, it might be you, it might be someone you know about, do get in touch. We are fire@crowdnetwork.co.uk.
And next week, Tom, the subject is Dylan.
Give me a quick Dylan impression. How does it feel?
Crowd Network.
A place where you belong.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune into Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, don't believe everything you read. Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.